Hello, this time on Sit Rep, RAF Typhoons join an air defence operation following Russian incursions into Polish and Romanian airspace. They'll work with allied forces, including France and Germany, helping to defend the eastern flank as part of NATO's Eastern Sentry. Also, President Trump's state visit to the UK is breaking military ceremonial records. We'll talk to a former deputy commander of ISAF about how intertwined UK and US forces are. And as world events are brought directly to our mobile devices, we speak to the author of a book looking at how the military must adapt to fighting wars in the age of the smartphone.
British fighter jets and a air-to-air tanker will be part of NATO's new airspace mission.
Defence Explained.
This will be the biggest state visit that I've been on with four full divisions.
This is SITREP with Kate Chabot.
RAF Typhoons will be carrying out round-trip air defence missions over Poland to counter aerial threats from Russia. It's all part of NATO's Eastern Sentry and comes just days after incursions by Russian drones into Poland's airspace and a further breach of Romanian airspace over the weekend. Mike is away this week, so a huge welcome to Dr. Karen von Hippel, who joins us for the duration. Karen is a former Director General of the Defence and Security think tank RUSTI and worked at the US State Department during the Obama administration. Hi, Karen. Good to see you. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me.
So this operation, Eastern Sentry, how significant is it and Britain's involvement?
I think it's really important. I don't think we've shown enough we haven't been tough enough on Russia. Russia for years now has been involved in numerous gray area tactics, whether that's digging up undersea cables, whether it's cyber attacks, whether that's even attempted assassination or assassinations of its overseas civilians. And so I think it's important that we show that there's zero tolerance, that allies really demonstrate strength. I think that's the only language that Putin really understands.
And BFPS Forces News' Simon Newton has also been looking into this. Simon, hello. Tell us about this operation. When does the air defence operation start?
Well, I think the details of how this will actually work are kind of emerging, but we understood when the release came out earlier this week that it would be within days. So those Typhoons are either already flying over Poland or they're about to start those missions. The French Rafales are already there in Poland, so they may well have begun operating. And the Dutch already have F-35s in Poland as part of an existing NATO mission. So that's likely to be rolled into this one, we expect. So, it's also worth noting that Poland has essentially put a kind of dawn to dusk no-fly zone, or at least a very restrictive zone over its eastern border until December, which excludes anything from except military jets in that particular area. So they're clearly preparing for this to start very soon, or it has already started.
And Simon, the sorties will be starting at RAF Coningsby in Lincolnshire, a long way from Poland. They'll be supported by RAF Voyager air-to-air refueling aircraft. How unusual is this?
Well, it's a good 1,200 miles from Lincolnshire to Warsaw. So it's a very long commute for these crews. But it's actually less than the Typhoons fly when they fly missions over Yemen against Houthi targets, about 400 miles less or so. So operating like this is very common for the RAF. They've done it. They did it for pretty close to a decade on Opshader over Iraq and Syria. They flew these long missions over that area. So, refueling several times on their way in and on their way out. So it's something they're very used to doing, something they train for. And as I understand it from talking to RAF people in the know, that one air tanker could sustain a pair of Typhoons over Poland for at least 4 hours of patrol time. So it's a very feasible operation in their eyes.
And why doesn't the UK, though, base its jets in Poland like France, or at least closer?
Well, initially, when we read the release, because it was quite nuanced, that was what you kind of got the idea they were going to do. But then it emerged that they're actually going to do this commute. So, we did have Typhoons in Poland until, I think, July as part of Operation Chessmen, which was this NATO air policing mission. The MOD told me, asked them that question. They said this is a much more effective and efficient way to actually operate. It means they haven't got to send all the accompanying support and the ground crews, if you like, that go with these jets. So there's a cost saving there. And there's also a diplomatic aspect to this. If they do it this way, it can easily be turned on and off. It can be more calibrated in their eyes. As I say, the French have already sent Rafales to Poland. Poland itself obviously has F-16s that it's operating, and the Germans are flying their Typhoons from Rostock, I believe, in northern Germany. So they too are doing some sort of transit in and out. How the Danes are going to operate their F-16s, though, that's not been decided yet, apparently.
And what can you tell us about the rules of engagement?
Not very much, really. I think I asked that question this week to NATO and to the MOD. All I really learned was that they will come under, these UK Typhoons will come under NATO doctrine, NATO rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. I did try to find out, you know, who would exactly tell these pilots to fire on Russian drones, but that's about as far as I got. I think they'll be controlled from the KAOC, the Combined Air Operations Centre in UDM in Germany, which is where NATO's Baltic Air Policing missions are controlled from. But the exact rules of engagement, however hard you dig, they are classified. So I wasn't able to find out exactly how that will work.
Karen, I saw you smiling when we talked about the lack of clarity or knowledge of the rules of engagement, at least in the public arena anyway. How effective do you think the deterrent will be?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in a sense, it's almost the beginning of the deterrence force they've been talking about to support a Ukraine peace process, which would be, you know, troops in the nearby region, and then, of course, backstopped by some sort of U.S. intelligence assets, U.S. air support. So in a sense, this is like almost an opening salvo of what that might look like. I think using fighter jets to shoot down drones is not very efficient. As we know, it's quite expensive. There's got to be other ways to do it. But yes, the concern would be, I think, as Simon was alluding to, is if it's a Russian jet with, you know, Russian pilots in it, what happens then? And what happens if NATO forces shoot down a Russian jet? I mean, that's really, that's where you would really want to know what the rules of engagement are.
It's also going to be very costly, Karen, with no set time frame. Presumably a longer term solution will need to be found.
Yeah, and a longer term solution is a peace process that is backstopped by NATO forces, that's backstopped in some way by the United States. We still don't have the commitment for the United States. And of course, we need to get Russia to the negotiating table to agree on all of this. And as we know, Russia has said no NATO troops on the ground. I wonder how they're going to feel about NATO air power in the area. They're not going to like that. And we do know that Russia really does try to test the limits of our resolve in all sorts of ways. So it'll be very interesting to see how they respond to this.
And Simon, it comes under the command of the Supreme Allied Commander, Europe, obviously an American at the top of this. What more can you tell us about American involvement or not in this particular operation?
I think, well, as Karen said, there'll undoubtedly be a big American involvement in terms of surveillance and intelligence, as there has been, you know, throughout this conflict in Ukraine. In terms of aircraft, there's no commitment of US jets, no F-15s are going to take part in this. But, you know, they may well be US AWACS, for instance, in the air playing some sort of part. But this is purely a European operation at the moment, and it obviously feeds into that kind of burden-sharing narrative that Pete Hegseth was very keen to talk about at that NATO defense ministers meeting earlier this year. So, you know, that the European countries need to get used to doing these things without American help.
All right, Simon, thank you for bringing us up to date on that. Thanks for your time. Well, the full ceremonial soft power of Britain's armed forces was mobilised for Donald Trump's record second state visit to the UK, and it's breaking military records too. 1,300 troops conducting a Guard of Honour. That's the first ever for a state visit of that size to the UK. The first time beating retreat has been performed during a state visit, and it would also have been the first time the UK and US militaries took part in a joint flypast for a state visit. Sadly, that bit had to be called off because of bad weather. But what we want to ask today is, behind the dazzling show of unity, how intertwined are UK and US militaries? And with the US president who wants Europe to take more responsibility for its own security, is it time to loosen those ties? Well, joining us now is General Sir Nick Parker, who served 40 years in the British Armed Forces and was Deputy Commander of ISAF in Afghanistan between 2009 and 2010. Sir Nick, great to have you on SITREP. Thank you very much for joining us. How big a consideration has the US military been in our calculations of what our forces can and should be doing during your career?
It went through a number of phases. When I first joined in the sort of early 70s, we had large armed forces, and we were not a peer, but very nearly a peer. We had our own core in Germany. We were able to operate and sustain over long distances, large forces. And also, the Americans were getting over Vietnam. They were really concentrating on themselves. In the middle of my career, towards the end of my career, when I first went to Baghdad in 2005, I was hugely impressed by the size, scale, and capability of the American armed forces. And I realized then that they were absolutely fundamental to the effectiveness of the overall operation. They provided, in military terms, the operational strength. And Britain had reduced its capability politically and physically to a position where it was a tactical force in a larger American operational effort. Mm. And in those circumstances, we, the sort of UK and joint chain of command, learnt to integrate with this very significant American capability.
And how was that integration process for you?
First thing that struck me was how impressed I was with the Americans' commitment. There was a commitment to engaging with the enemy, certainly in Iraq, which then continued into Afghanistan, which was extraordinarily impressive. And it was backed up by capabilities that really brought them into the fight in the most effective way.
And ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force, was a multinational mission. It was standard for it to be under US command when you were deputy commander. Can you tell me how it ran for you and how it ran with US counterparts on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so I had an American boss. I was the UK's national contingent commander, but my principal role was as a ISAF member of the ISAF chain of command. It would only have worked if the Americans had been there. The British had capabilities in Helmand, and the Dutch in their area, and the French and the Turks. They had their own capabilities dotted around the country, but the thing was brought together by American capability. So we would not have been able to do what we were doing in Afghanistan without them.
And what was it the Americans could do that no one else could?
Well, they can shift 30,000 troops from December 2009 to March 2010 from CONUS into Afghanistan without batting an eyelid. We could never do that.
Karen, the UK and US military exercise together. They're designed to do the task they've been set to do and to get on with it. But a coalition really does only work as long as there is a political will to back it up.
But I mean, just to back up what General Sir Nick was saying, I mean, the US-UK relationship is wide and deep. It's been decades in the making. It goes well beyond what the political leaders think of each other. And it's on the civilian and the military spheres. I mean, I certainly recall in the three different jobs I had at the State Department doing counterterrorism and conflict that, you know, almost every day we worked very closely with our British counterparts. We had British embeds in our office, and certainly on the military side, I remember even when the U.S. military would say, you know, actually the best briefings we had were by British soldiers to help us figure out how to manage these situations. So, you know, it was one of respect, and it was a deep partnership. It was very quiet. It was understated. It was just taken for granted. Now, of course, it's hard to say what might happen if there's a big rift between the two countries. I can't really imagine that happening, but, you know, anything is possible. So until such time, it almost doesn't matter who the political leaders are if they're, you know, working in partnership on a joint endeavor.
It doesn't matter who the political leaders are, Sir Nick. So is the US and the UK military, will they continue to work together as they have, irrespective of what Donald Trump says about the UK and Europe stepping up and taking more responsibility for its own security?
I think we want to be careful about using about focusing on the president or on an individual. I mean, just to add a slightly different perspective, I used to find when I was working with the Americans that I was sometimes confronted by a frustration that they were investing so heavily in these endeavours, and that we were always limiting, you know, 10,000 troops, that there was this political constraint from Britain and other countries, whereas the Americans were the ultimate underwriter. Mm. What we've seen over the last few months is that the Americans have expected us to stand up to the plate, that they want the Europeans to pull their fingers out. And I think, certainly as a professional soldier, I think that's an entirely reasonable thing to want to do. I mean, the Americans have this broader global geostrategic view that looks to the West as much as it looks to the East. They don't view Russia in the same way that we do, for all sorts of reasons, and they expect us to deal with our own immediate security. That's reasonable. I think where I have genuine concerns is that in order to transform from a tactical player, which is what we've been, well, we've been relying on the Americans, into a country which has a genuine strategic and operational capability, there is a massive amount of investment required. And it doesn't happen overnight. In order to build the sort of capabilities that can shift, and I go back to my previous example, 30,000 troops with all their enablers in 4 months from one side of the globe to the other, to build that capability requires investment in all sorts of areas and build experience. And if you're going to do that, you need to make it absolutely clear where your priorities are. And I haven't yet seen, I mean, I've seen 250 million defense budgets appearing, but I haven't seen the depth of commitment that I believe is needed to shift our defensive capabilities into a position where they are resilient, where they can operate under a purely national line without depending on a US underwrite.
And do you think, Karen, that this is the case, that Britain really does have to move from being a tactical partner and do what is required in order to loosen that dependence on US?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen that America is no longer going to be the reliable ally that it has been in the past. And even after Donald Trump leaves, we don't know if a future Trump-like president will be elected in the United States and won't be interested in working with allies. So it is important for the UK and European powers to build up their defense and strengthen their resilience in all sorts of ways, not just because it's important for their own security, but also then you can deal with America more as a peer rather than as sort of a second tier power. But don't forget, there's also, the investments in advanced technology. Yes, I agree with General Cernik that we're far away from being in that situation, but we also are investing in advanced technology. And, you know, modern wars are really, I mean, it's quite interesting what Ukraine has shown us in terms of the role that drones play and robots have been playing and AI has been playing. And so it's not just about brute strength on the ground. It's a far more complicated package.
And if I can just draw, Karen, from your experience when you were Chief of Staff to General Allen in 2015, who was the US Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to counter ISIL, he had to coordinate the international coalition, including the UK. What did you experience at the time of working relationship between the US and the UK? And do you think it's changed in the way that kind of Nick has laid out earlier?
Yeah, well, it was a different time. It was a US president that cared deeply about partnerships. The commander, or my boss, General Allen, cared deeply about partnerships and had worked as he was also commander at ISAF. So he had run coalitions before, and he treated everybody in the coalition as a peer. He didn't treat them as, you know, that they worked for him. And the Brits did a very important job and came up with a lot of really critical ideas. What we were doing was a non-kinetic side of the coalition. So there was a separate effort, a military effort run by the Pentagon. The State Department, where General John Allen was, we were dealing with the non-kinetic, which was everything from how do you deal with foreign fighters to terror financing to strategic communications. And so sort of legal and financial and other tools to push back. But yes, it was but you have a very different president who is less interested in that kind of a partnership right now.
And so, Nick, you said just before that, you know, Britain has to move away from being this tactical partner to the US military. And I'm just wondering, you say that there haven't been the signs of the investment that's needed to do that at the moment so far. What are the consequences if it doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen quickly enough?
2 points. The first, Karen's absolutely right. This is not just about thousands more troops. It's about developing a contemporary capability that is formed of all the new ways that one can conduct warfare. So it's quite complicated, but it needs real messaging. So we may not be ready or in every respect for 5 years or 8 years or 10 years, but we've got to make it really clear in our messaging where we're moving and show how our capabilities are developing incrementally, so that if anybody chooses to mess with us, they realize that they're going to get a bloody nose. So that we build a credible, effectively independent deterrence that is below the nuclear threshold, so that we as a country become resilient and can play our part with our immediate neighbors. And just to very quickly, there is a hugely important distinction between NATO and the US. When I was in Afghanistan, the operation was a NATO operation. They were completely irrelevant. The people who ran the operation were from Washington down to headquarters ISAF. We used to spend a lot of our time talking to NATO and keeping them happy, but the big decisions were all made on the US national chain. When I was advising the Minister of Defense in Ukraine 2016 to 2019, it was very clear there that NATO was fine as a strategic convener, but as soon as one country decided that it wasn't happy with what was going on, it blocked NATO's ability to do anything, and bilateral or trilateral relationships between NATO countries and Ukraine were the things that made things happen. NATO may be a great strategic convener, but it has to transform so that it can produce effective structures around those of us who are going to operate with less of an American underwrite as a credible strategic, operational, and tactical organization.
And on that note, we'll leave that thought for the moment and perhaps talk about it another time in more detail. General Sir Nick Parker, it's been great having you on SITREP. Thank you very much. Now, the smartphone as a weapon of war and its impact on modern conflict have been examined for a new book. It lays out how military organisations are affected right down to the individual soldier on the ground and how civilians are also drawn in. War in the Smartphone Age was written by Matthew Ford, a former strategic analyst at DSTL, the Defence Science and Technology Laboratory, who is now Associate Professor of War Studies at the Swedish Defence University.
You've got a situation where you're not only just using the smartphone as you might ordinarily just to share on social media, but also you can upload important information to intelligence fusion cells, which then becomes useful from a military targeting point of view. Clearly, soldiers are instructed not to take their smart technology with them. But sometimes you end up doing that because it becomes a backup in a difficult situation, and then you're relying on civilian information infrastructures to communicate. But it's not just soldiers, of course, it's also civilians. People are in and around the battlefield, and they themselves have their devices, and they then become important sources of information from a military point of view. But also they're literally filming tanks rolling down the street and uploading that to social media. The intelligence ecosystem has changed as different armed forces realize that these are sources of intelligence that need to be controlled. So at the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the battlefield was a lot more transparent. But these devices become things that militaries need to become a lot more aware of when they are operating in and amongst civilians.
Yes, they do, don't they? And how should modern militaries adapt their training then, do you think, to incorporate the reality that every soldier is now and can be a player in a digital connected battle space via the smartphone?
I mean, I was at the Naval Postgraduate in Monterey, and without wanting to break confidences, the officers I was talking to were always instructing their sergeants to go through their unit to make sure that no one had a connected device on them. And so, of course, it seems to me that we know we shouldn't be carrying these things around, but actually, you know, in order to stay in touch with friends, family, to watch films, to alleviate boredom, all the rest of it, you know, people end up carrying these things with them. I think some of the education and training needs to reflect the practical realities of just how connected we are, rather than just assume that these devices are automatically bad. I mean, they clearly can be very, very dangerous if they are not switched off or people aren't careful about where they are located when they go towards the front lines. But at the same time, you know, people are... their downtime is made more comfortable by being able to watch films and do all the things that everyone does when they at home using a tablet or to watch a film or whatever. So I think it's a balance.
What impact does it have on soldiers or units on the battlefield, though, when their movements, their actions, or even their mistakes can be filmed and broadcast by civilians or adversaries in real time, or even falsified?
Yeah, so I think that the falsification is the real challenge. Well, one of the bigger challenges now. I mean, it's really hard to understand the provenance of some of this source material. And some of the research I did for my book was me, you know, that was started in 2022 for this my latest book. And, you know, one of the challenges I set myself was to try and understand the provenance of some of the source material. What's taken? What images are taken by mainstream media, by journalists, by webcams or street cams, and then, you know, by helmet cams, and then by people using their phones. And so you've got to understand all of the different source materials that are available. And that then helps you make more sense as to what's going on online and might give you a better idea as to how to differentiate between fake news and real news. Mm-hmm. The underlying thing, it seems to me, is that if civilians are carrying these things, soldiers don't really know whether they are filming them for the purposes of sharing intelligence with an intelligence cell, or they are just filming them because there's a tank running down the road. And then you've got a real conundrum for soldiers as to whether the civilian is actively participating in the conflict or is just sort of a bystander. And one of the claims I would make is that by literally just carrying a phone in your pocket, you know, that becomes very, very problematic. I would not say that it's okay to shoot first, ask questions later. There's the laws of armed conflict, but I can understand that this complicates the rules of engagement in a very significant way and makes life for soldiers very, very difficult.
Mm. Does that mean that the rules of engagement have to be reconsidered then in that light?
Yeah, I think, I think you know, there's been examples. So Bucha in Ukraine, Russians were shooting civilians because they had smartphones in their pockets. Now, were they using their smartphones for the purposes of intelligence or not? I don't, you know, they're not. And the Russians have been prosecuted for war crimes for those attacks on civilians. At the same time, you can see, without excusing the behavior, you can see why they might be doing that. Now, that could also be, you know, a actual political decision around genocide, to commit genocide. I have to say, I don't know how we would be in this kind of situation, and I think it puts a lot of people in a lot of difficult spots, really, to be honest. And I would imagine the rules of engagement will have to be very, very tightly managed in those situations.
And the problem is here is about the blurring of civilian and combatant roles, isn't it, through social media. How can armed forces protect their operational security?
This is a very good question, and the one thing they might the armed forces might try to do is try to limit connectivity on the battlefield, and of course, or at least manipulate information speed and flow. I think the underlying challenge is that civilian communications technology is much more sophisticated and better in many ways than the military's. You've got capacity to broadcast more data with a smartphone than you have over Bowman, for example. And so civilians are a real advantage when it comes to sharing information. Now, just because you switch off the internet for a moment doesn't mean that people are still not recording what's happening. Mm. And, you know, when the internet goes back on, then, of course, then they upload again. And, it slows down information distribution, but doesn't necessarily stop it.
And what are the risks then of relying on commercial platforms and data infrastructures that are not under military or state control but are crucial in conflicts today?
Well, so I think probably armed forces are needing to spend more time meshing military comms infrastructure with civilians. So actually the real problem becomes the militarization of civilian communications infrastructure. I mean, most military comms happen over civilian infrastructures anyway. It's the stuff that's particularly classified that starts to go over a military infrastructure. The question is, I suppose, for civilian communities, how happy they are with their infrastructure being used in this way, and in some ways, you know, military comms being buried in civilian communication infrastructure, because, you know, that starts to compromise combatants. You know, where do you draw the line? People working at Google, they are, I would argue, you know, effectively the munitions workers of the 21st century. They are providing the software, hardware infrastructure that enables the armed forces to work, and potentially, at least especially when it comes to using smartphone technology in the battlefield, and, you know, they themselves could become combatants.
How do you see the integration of AI, data analytics, and smartphone-derived imagery affecting the fighting of wars, and how does the MOD keep pace with that?
I think this is a very, very difficult challenge. I mean, at the moment, I think we're at a liminal space between AI has got a long way to go before it really takes off, and there's going to be a lot of difficult choices for the armed forces, for the Ministry of Defence, about how to integrate and make use of that. And they will probably be around organisational culture and military structure. And that potentially could be very significant in the types of changes that the armed forces have to face. But that's assuming, of course, that these platforms can be made to work. And in the meantime, we've got the kind of situation I describe in my book, where, you know, we've got an enormous availability of data producing devices like the smartphone, and somewhere down the lines we need to sift and make sense of that. Now, that's no longer humanly, you know, we can't do it as individuals. We need some computational assistance in that. And the question is whether what platforms might be used to help sift the noise, the signal for the noise. And clearly there's a lot of work being put into trying to make sense of this. I think the danger is that we end up with a sort of loss of understanding about how the analysis side of things works, because we're reliant on the software to help derive pattern and analysis, when actually, and that potentially could lead to sort of tunnel vision. You know, we're going to rely on the technology in a way that actually we need to be thinking critically about using the technology much more carefully and as a tool for interrogating what we're seeing, rather than something we become reliant on.
And in a word, has this made the battlefield more or less transparent?
That's a really good question. I think things are more complicated. And I think you put your finger on it when you start to look at how deepfakes and other bits of information, you know, this complicates. Both sides are aware of this. So both sides start to manipulate what might be a transparent battle space in order to try and hide the real story from inside the noise of the data that we're all producing using our smartphones.
Matthew Ford, it's been great speaking to you. Thank you very much. Karen, we often talk on SITREP about how quickly technology is developing and affecting modern warfare. You were in Ukraine quite recently. What did you observe there?
Well, I mean, it was really interesting listening to Matthew. His book sounds incredible because, I mean, of course, it was over a year ago when I was there in August of 2024. But I saw all of that. I mean, certainly we heard about civilians often providing information to to the Ukrainian military through their smartphones. We saw the Ukrainians taking advantage of Russians using Telegram on the battlefield and, you know, intercepting that. But the innovation was happening so fast, every 2 to 3 weeks, the Russians or the Ukrainians would be tweaking what they were doing and how they were responding, that it's really hard for, I think, a number of Western defense companies to stay abreast of those innovations. And they're quite cheap, too. So, you know, you often meet companies that are making drones, but they cost $1 million a drone or something, where the Ukrainians and the Russians are making them for very little money. And so I think it poses a real challenge, not just in terms of the advances in innovation, but also, as Matthew was saying, about the misinformation and the attempts at decoys and deception. It's really hard to manage all that. Ukrainians have been incredible at it, actually, but the Russians have been as well.
Karen, listen, it's been really great having you on SITREP today. Thank you very much for your time. And my thanks to all of our guests. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.